So Alan Weissman is an award-winning journalist, author, and radio producer. His writings have appeared in Harper's, New York Times, The Atlantic Monthly, and many others. Other books of his include An Echo in My Blood, Gaviotas, A Village to Reinvent the World, which won the 1998 Social Inventions Award. Mr. Weissman has also received awards for other writings, some of his reporting, and also some of his broadcasts. He is a senior radio producer for Homelands Productions and currently teaches international journalism at the University of Arizona. Recently, you may have seen Alan on the Today Show or the Jon Stewart Show. He's had quite a lot of media and buzz about his latest book, The World Without Us. Alan currently lives in Massachusetts with his wife, and the format for this evening is he will present his book to us for probably about 40 to 45 minutes, and then we'll take question and answers as you come up with them, and then also be available to sign any books if you'd like. So please join me in welcoming Alan Weissman to Vancouver this evening.
Thank you very much. For the past 20 years, I have had the privilege as a journalist to cover the most important story on Earth, which is to say, the Earth itself. This has taken me to some magnificent places and to some frightening places, and oftentimes those are one and the same, such as Antarctica with an ozone hole hanging over it. The splendors of the Amazon, but also the fires and the saw blades that are bringing it down. The steppes and the rivers of my father's homeland, the Ukraine, and the Chernobyl nuclear plant that defiled them. The frozen Arctic here in Canada, Northwest Territories, which is now becoming the thawing Arctic. The more that I have seen, the more that I have learned, the harder my job has become. Because it's become increasingly clear to me and to my colleagues that it's extraordinarily urgent that we, all of us, understand what's going on our planet before it's too late. Too late for us, too late for the planet. But that urgency has made things more difficult because at a certain point, who wants to read this depressing, sometimes downright scary stuff? I mean, frankly, I don't. But it's so important that for some time I've realized I needed to find a way to tell the story, the complete story, as I've had the privilege to cover it from pole to pole, and cover how it all connects through us. A way to tell that story without pulling any punches, without oversimplifying or minimizing, and yet do it from some fresh and unexpected way that would be so intriguing that readers would stop worrying about, does this mean we're all going to die? And keep turning the pages, keep wanting to read. So I figured out that maybe it would be intriguing to just kill everybody off right away. But the way I set it up in the book, and I'm going to read you a couple of fragments from the book and then talk about some of the stuff in between, is I set it up as an experiment, a creative experiment, that we suppose that the worst has already happened, that human extinction is already a fait accompli. But not by nuclear calamity or asteroid collision or anything ruinous enough that it wipes out most everything else, nor by some grim eco-scenario in which we agonizingly fade and drag down many other species with us in the process. But instead, imagine a world from which we all just suddenly vanished, like tomorrow. Okay, it's unlikely, perhaps, but for the sake of argument, it's not impossible. say a Homo sapiens specific virus, natural or diabolically nanoengineered, picks us off but leaves everything else. I mean, let's say AIDS were airborne, for example. Or some misanthropic evil wizard somehow targets the 3.9% of DNA that makes us human beings and not chimpanzees, or perfects a way to sterilize our sperm. Or Jesus or space aliens rapture us away, either to our heavenly glory or to a zoo across the galaxy somewhere. Just look around you. Look at today's world. Look at your house, your city, and the surrounding land, the pavement underneath, and the soil hidden below that. Leave it all in place, but extract the human beings. Wipe us out. See what's left. How long would the rest of nature, or how would the rest of nature respond if it were suddenly relieved of the relentless pressures that we heap on it and our fellow organisms? How soon would or could the climate return to where it was before we fired up all our engines? How long would it take to recover lost ground and restore Eden to the way it must have gleamed and smelled the day before Adam or Homo habilis, the predecessor of Homo sapiens, appeared? Could nature ever obliterate all of our traces? How would it undo our monumental cities and our public works and reduce our myriad plastics and toxic synthetics back to benign basic elements? Or are some so unnatural that they're indestructible? And what of our finest creations, our architecture, our art, our many manifestations of spirit? Are any truly timeless, or at least enough so to last until the sun expands and roasts the earth to a cinder? And even after that, might we have left some faint, enduring mark on the universe, some lasting glow or echo of earthly humanity, some interplanetary sign that once we were here? Well, for a sense of how the world will go on without us, among other places, we have to look at the world before us. We're not time travelers. The fossil record's only a fragmentary sampling. But even if that record were complete, the future wouldn't perfectly mirror the past. We've ground some species so thoroughly into extinction that they or their DNA will likely never spring back. So since some things we've done are likely irrevocable, what would remain in our absence would not be the same planet had we never evolved in the first place. And it might not be so different either. As nature's been through worse losses before, and it's refilled empty niches, and even today there are still a few earthly spots where all our senses can inhale a living memory of this Eden before we were here. Inevitably, they invite us to wonder how nature might flourish if granted the chance. Now, since we're imagining, why not also dream of a way for nature to prosper that doesn't depend on our demise? We are, after all, mammals ourselves. Every life form adds to this vast pageant. With our passing, might some lost contribution of ours leave the planet a bit more impoverished? Is it possible that instead of heaving a huge biological sigh of relief, the world without us would miss us? Well, thus begins my book, The World Without Us, and I start in a few places that are familiar to readers, except what I learned in my research is that what is familiar can be surprising. For instance, you may have never heard of the Bialowice Pusha, but if you were raised somewhere in the temperate swath that crosses much of North America, Japan, Korea, the former Soviet Union, parts of China, Turkey, Eastern, Western Europe, including the British Isles, something within you remembers it. Pusz is an old Polish word, means forest primeval. Straddling the border between Poland and Belarus, the 500,000 acres of Bialowice Pusza contain Europe's last remaining fragment of old-growth lowland wilderness. Now, think of the misty, brooding forest that loomed behind your eyelids when, as a child, someone read you Grimm's fairy tales. Here, the ash and linden trees tower nearly 150 feet in their huge canopy shade a moist, tangled understory of hornbeams and ferns, swamp alders, fungi the size of crockery. Oaks shrouded with a half millennia of moss grow so immense that great spotted woodpeckers store spruce cones in the 3-inch deep bark furrows. The air is thick and cool and draped with a silence that parts briefly for a nutcracker's croak or a pygmy owl's whistle, or a wolf's wail, and then returns to stillness. The fragrance that wafts from eons of accumulated mulch in the forest's core harken to fertility's very origins. In the Bialavaisa, the profusion of life owes much to all that is dead, as a quarter of the organic mass above ground is in assorted stages of decay. If decomposing trunks and fallen branches on every acre, which nourish thousands of species of mushrooms, lichens, bark beetles, grubs, and microbes that are missing from orderly managed woodlands that passes for us elsewhere. And together, those species stock a sylvan larder that provide for weasels and pine martens, raccoons, badgers, otters, foxes, lynx, wolves, roe deer, elk, eagles, even bison, European bison. More kinds of life are found in this forest than anywhere else on the continent, and yet there are no surrounding mountains or sheltering valleys to form unique niches for endemic species. The Bialavaisa pusha is simply a relic of what once stretched east to Siberia and west to Ireland. Now, the existence of a place in Europe, such a legacy of unbroken biological antiquity, unsurprisingly owes to high privilege. During the 14th century, a Lithuanian duke successfully allied his duchy with the Kingdom of Poland. He married the queen and declared the forest a royal hunting preserve, and for centuries it stayed that way. And a series of Polish kings gave way to a series of Russian czars, and then all the way up to World War II, or World War I, actually, occupying Germans took some of the lumber and slaughtered game. But a pristine core was left, and in 1921 it became a Polish national park. During World War II, the Nazis invaded, but a nature fanatic named Hermann Göring, great lover of life, decreed the entire preserve off limits, and except by his pleasure. Well, after World War II, the story I understand is that the Poles got Joseph Stalin very drunk in Warsaw and got him to agree to keep it a national park, and there it has stayed, and now it belongs to Poland and Belarus. But the important part that I want you to know about this is when you go in there, it's just startling to think that all Europe once looked like this pusha, because when you enter it, you realize that most of us were bred to a pale copy of what nature intended. You see elders with trunks 7 feet wide, and you walk through stands of the tallest trees that are these gigantic Norway spruce and as shaggy as Methuselah. You'd think that would seem as exotic as the Amazon or Antarctica to someone who's raised among the comparatively puny second-growth woodlands found throughout most of the Northern Hemisphere. But instead, what's astonishing is how primally familiar it feels, and on some cellular level, how complete. Our bodies remember. They remember the world when it was fresh. You know, the initial reaction of 80 to 90% of the people who I talked to when I tell them, I explained that I was writing a book about a world without people, and it was, oh, God, that sounds so great. You know, but, you know, later, of course, when they thought about it more, there was an almost inevitable reflection of, yeah, but wouldn't it be such a shame, though, if that in order to bring nature back to full flower meant that humans had to go? Because after all, we've created our share of incredible beauty on this planet. And those two notions, the fact that we remember, something in us remembers, and the fact that we still would like to be a part of something like that, formed really the structure for a book like this. First of all, what I had to do was try to understand and show people, you know, what it was that has so walled us off from the earth that we've lost touch with it. And also what would happen to those walls if we suddenly vanished. So, a couple of examples here. On the day after humans disappear, nature takes over and immediately begins cleaning houses, that is, cleans them right off the face of the earth. They all go. Now, if you're a homeowner, you already knew it was only a matter of time for yours. But you've resisted, admitted it, even as erosion callously attacks, starting with your savings. And back when they told you what your house would cost, nobody mentioned what you'd also be paying so that nature wouldn't repossess it long before the bank. I mean, even if you live in a denatured postmodern subdivision where heavy machines mash the landscape into submission, replacing unruly native flora with obedient sod and uniform saplings, paving wetlands in the righteous name of mosquito control, even then you know that nature wasn't fazed. So no matter how hermetically you've sealed your temperature-tuned interior from the wind, from the weather, invisible spores penetrate anyway, exploding in sudden outbursts of mold. It's awful when you see it. Worse when you don't, because it's hidden behind a painted wall, munching paper sandwiches of gypsum board and rotting studs and floor joists. Or you've been colonized by termites or carpenter ants, roaches, hornets, small mammals. But most of all, you are beset by what in other contexts is the veritable stuff of life. Water. It always wants in. So after we're gone, nature's revenge for our smug mechanized superiority arrives waterborne. It starts in the case of wood frame construction, which is the most widely used residential building technique in the developed world, up on the roof, which is probably asphalt or slate shingle and warranted to last two or three decades, but the warranty doesn't count around the chimney where the first leak occurs. Unless you have a skylight, then may have even beaten the chimney. But the result is, as the flashing separates under rain's relentless insistence, water sneaks beneath the shingles. And it flows across these 4-by-8-foot sheets of sheathing made either of plywood or, if newer, wood chipboard that's composed of these 3-to-4-inch flakes of timber bonded together by a resin. Now, newer isn't necessarily better. Wernher von Braun, the German scientist who developed the U.S. space program, used to tell a story about Colonel John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth. Seconds before liftoff, with Glenn strapped into that rocket we built for him and man's best efforts all focused on that moment, you know what he said to himself? Oh my God, I'm sitting on a pile of low bids. Well, in your new house, you've been sitting under one. And on the other hand, that's all right, because by building things so cheaply and lightly, we use fewer of the world's resources. On the other hand, the massive trees that yielded the great wooden posts and beams that still support medieval architecture in Europe, Japan, the early America, they're now too precious and they're too rare, so we're left to do with gluing together smaller boards and scraps. Now, that resin in your cost-conscious choice of a wood chip roof is a waterproof goo of formaldehyde and phenol polymer, and it was also applied along the board's exposed edges. But it fails anyway because moisture enters around the nails. And soon they're rusting and their grip begins to loosen, which presently leads not only to interior leaks but to structural mayhem. Because underlying the roofing, the wooden sheathing secures trusses to each other. And these trusses, those are those pre-manufactured braces that are held together with metal connection plates. They're there to keep the roof from splaying. But when the sheathing goes, the structural integrity grows with it. And, you know, I'm not going to keep punishing you homeowners anymore. I mean, there's a lot more gory detail in here that shows what happens as those little connection plates start to loosen up and enzymes start to penetrate and start eating all kinds of things. And your wooden house, within a century, most of it's going to be lying on the ground. The chimney will be up, though some of the bricks will be falling out. The ceramic tile of your bathroom, that's the most durable thing in your house. It will last as long as fossils last. It's kind of the same, but they'll be lying on the ground as well. And I go in and I explain the heat ducts, all of those things. But, you know, it's one thing for us to imagine, okay, a house can fall apart. We've seen that. But what about a big steel concrete city? I mean, how could nature bring that? Could it possibly bring it back to forest? And that's exactly the question I asked. I went to kind of the epitome of all urban shells, Manhattan Island, which either we've all been there or we've seen it, you know, in the movies. And it's wall-to-wall cement. And I asked city engineers and I asked structural engineers and scientists and biologists. What was here before? It was a forest when Henry Hudson first saw it. Could that ever come back? And their answer was, not only could it, but absolutely it would. And it turns out that our cities also have great vulnerability. So I started by going down underneath the city with subway maintenance personnel. And the reason is because Manhattan, it's derived from an old Algonquin name that means hilly. This was once a hilly island. It had about 40 rivers and streams that would wick moisture, wick water, wick rain off to the sea. If you can think in your mind's eye where the Plaza Hotel is at the base of Central Park, that used to be a lake and there was a river running off to the East River and there was a big ridge line on the west side that had streams going in both directions, and this ridge line was basically a bobcat and deer trail. Today we call it Broadway. But all that stuff got flattened down and all the water courses got pushed underground when they superimposed the grid on the city. But it still rains there, as the subway engineers showed me, and that's why they have to maintain nearly 800 pumps under the city to constantly be pumping groundwater that would otherwise flood the subway tunnels. And 13 million gallons a day, that's on a sunny day. When it rains, it gets real serious. And any rainfall over 2 inches, which they're having more frequently these days, that's emergency mode. And I describe in here what they describe to me. The subways would flood within 2 or 3 days if nobody was there maintaining them, if the power was off to those pumps, if no one were in the power plants. And then the steel columns that hold up the street would start to rust, they would start to corrode, and within a couple of decades, they would collapse one after another, and the streets would start to crater, and then there would be rivers on the surface in Manhattan, and birds would start dropping fish or clams in them, and then pretty soon we'd have live rivers. In the meantime, what happens in a city when nobody's maintaining the streets and the sidewalks? Well, an uncountable number of garbage bags, plastic bags, will be clogging the sewers very quickly, and leaf litter, which is not, leaves aren't being raked from Central Park in New York, Stanley Park here, all your other beautiful parks, all that stuff would start filling the gutters, and it would provide just a wonderful wet mulchy medium for seeds to start sprouting in. Seeds constantly sprout in cracks in sidewalks. You know, in a northern city, I know you don't get a lot of freezes here in Vancouver, but the rest of Canada certainly understands that in the springtime, snow will thaw and the runoff will go into a crack and then it'll freeze at night again and the crack will get bigger. You know, the ice expands. And then seeds will lodge in those things. It's a constant battle for maintenance people to get rid of these things before they turn into flowers or they turn into trees or they turn into weeds that will actually heave concrete apart. The stuff that starts growing in that leaf litter that is filling the streets isn't even going to need cracks. It will start making its own. The roots will start going down and plants will start coming down the streets and colonizing. Fire will set in fairly soon when there are no firemen out there and there are no one clearing away dead branches or debris from the parks, and fire starts leaping to buildings, which it certainly will, if not right away, within a decade or so, as lightning rods start to corrode. It'll start burning the paper inside the buildings, the insulation. All that stuff will add new nutrients to this growing soil cap over the asphalt, and other plants will be less acid tolerant, will be able to also join as inside the buildings. This freeze thaw will also be, water pipes will have burst and waterlogged rebar inside the concrete will start to rust and it will start to pop facing off of the concrete, and crumbling concrete will add lime to the soil. It's amazing how quickly it will happen. Every person that I talked to was in absolute agreement. And you know, it's not really what my book's about, but it's kind of a subtext that comes through here. I remember thinking about it when I was off with a bridge expert who is in charge of some of the bridges that connects Manhattan to the mainland. And, you know, he showed me how in places where you got a couple steel plates going, a bird will just, you know, fly by, defecate out a seed. All the seed needs is that little bit of bird fertilizer to lodge into a crack between two big steel plates, and tree roots will start pushing them apart. Also, if nobody is maintaining the bridges by painting them so they don't rust or cleaning out the debris of the expansion joints, you know, bridges expand and contract summer and winter, if those things get filled with rust, rust takes up an awful lot of space, rivets will start to pop. And the bridge will finally have to expand somewhere. It'll start breaking the bolts that connect it to the land. So this subtext that I was mentioning, I don't talk about directly in the book, but it's pretty implicit. And it's kind of a loaded subject here in Vancouver, I understand, is that I interview hundreds of people for this book. I go all over the world, all these different experts. And it was only later that I realized I didn't interview any politicians or policymakers because they really don't have an awful lot to do with our civilization, other than causing problems. I mean, forgive me if I'm addressing anybody directly, but I mean, imagine a world without politicians. I mean, I keep writing. Those of you who are in commerce, you'd keep, you know, you guys would keep selling books. I mean, we'd keep trading. We keep doing the stuff that we do. But imagine a world without maintenance workers. I mean, they're really the unsung heroes of, you know, of our society. And without these people showing up at our nuclear plants every day, you know, well, I'm just going to say it, carrying off the garbage, keeping the subways pumped, keeping the bridges intact, our civilization would crumble. So I've gained enormous respect in doing this book for the people who hold civilization together, because I have learned how fragile it is and how nature would make fairly short work of it if we weren't here. I describe in here how one of the things that would happen, though, is that the forest that reclaims Manhattan or the forest that would reclaim Vancouver would not be exactly the same original forest that was seen before, because we've introduced lots of other species. And there would be a big free-for-all to see which native species, you know, would outfight, outcompete some of the interlopers, like English ivy. Is probably not going to do as well as poison ivy in some places. On the other hand, a lot of our import trees, Chinese waxberry, ailanthus, stuff like that, they have come here to stay, and they're going to be around for a long time. It's part of our legacy to the world. But as I was standing in the New York Botanical Gardens with a botanist, they've got this 40-acre stretch patch of uncut, untimbered old growth there, which has now been invaded. 50% of it is non-native species. A botanist there said to me, you know, in some ways that's not all that bad. It's kind of blasphemous these days to say that, you know, it's okay to have exotic species, but I mean, think of it. We're fine on a human level. We love societies like New York or Vancouver. I mean, one of the great multicultural cities of the world, because you get all these different exotic cultures mixing it up. And yet we get so xenophobic about native plants. He says, ultimately, the bottom line is what's important is that it's a functioning ecosystem, that the plants are still, the trees are filtering the air and they're purifying the water and they're holding the soil so it all doesn't just wash away down the rivers. This is a guy who, like me, has traveled throughout the world, and he has seen Brazil nut groves in the middle of the Amazon or durian trees in Indonesia or tea trees in Burma in the middle of the wilderness. But what you're looking at when you see these things, you're looking at the relic of a human society that was once there and valued these things and cultivated them. They're gone. But their echo remains in this living legacy in the forest. And in some ways, that's not so bad to think that we'll be remembered or our presence will be there, even if nobody remembers us at all. Well, I go to a lot of places, as I mentioned. I went to Africa because I was interested in seeing, well, what was the world like before us? And it turns out, as I talked to paleoecologists, they explained that on all the great land masses of the world, there were huge animals. North America, where we live, there were three times as many species, over a ton, as you have in Africa today, which raised a couple questions. And, you know, what happened to them? Well, there's controversy out there, but it looks pretty suspicious, the coincidence of the arrival of humans to stay on each continent and the disappearance of all these big animals. Another question is, how come Africa still has them? Well, the answer that scientists give is that the animals in Africa evolved alongside human beings, and they learned evasive techniques to deal with the latest predator. You know, just like lions don't get all the zebras or all the ostriches because, you know, those species learn how to protect themselves, they have against human beings. Though human beings have become enormously effective in recent times. But I went to Africa to get a sense of what it's like to be in a world surrounded by really large creatures. And ultimately that got me to wonder, well, if we evolved in Africa, how come we evolved at all? So I went off to see chimpanzees in the wild. I went to the shores of Lake Tanganyika, where Jane Goodall has done a lot of her studies, and the director of primate research there took me off to find chimpanzees. And one of the things that I wanted to, I mean, there's no way to answer this, but I wanted to ask a chimpanzee in the wild, what was, you know, they are our siblings, you know. Chimpanzees and a similar species called bonobo and us, we have a common ancestor. And at a certain point, we broke off. And, you know, why was that? Well, I faced a chimpanzee and I sort of put the question, and all I got was a stare back with some very intelligent eyes. He was not particularly impressed or intimidated by this primate, me. But as I talk to the ecologists who look at these animals and the environment around them, it's rather interesting to realize that at the time that our lineage split, there were ice ages, repeated ice ages going on in the world. Now, ice caps don't cover Africa particularly, but when all that moisture is locked up in the ice, Africa has a drought. And the forests had shrunk considerably. Now, what happens when resources shrink considerably? Well, the ones that are in there start fighting over what there is. So even though we like to think of ourselves as these great heroic risk takers who climbed out of the trees and ventured off across the savannas and over the horizon to discover new worlds, it's possible that we were the losers of that battle, that the chimpanzees won and they kicked us out. And your ancestors and mine, thankfully, were the ones that, I mean, literally had to learn to stand on their own 2 feet so they could see over the grass and see the lions bounding at them and figure out, and somehow, yes, they managed to survive. And we went on and we did colonize and we did what nature tends to do, some very creative, adaptive features to learn how to live in a new kind of ecosystem. It kills off some individuals and sometimes entire species. One of the examples of this that I saw in my book was when I went to Chernobyl. Chernobyl is a very interesting science experiment that's going on right now. It's noteworthy that there's this 30-kilometer evacuated zone around the reactor, and humans don't live there, but nature has rushed in. I mean, when I first saw the place, you know, the hedges were around houses were growing so high they were starting to cover up the walls, and the pavement was starting to break up. And scientists now are looking at it, so there's many times the biodiversity in the evacuated zone as there is outside where there's still humans living. So in some ways, in fact, one researcher was quoted on Ukrainian TV saying it's the best thing that's happened to the Ukrainian environment. Now, it looks beautiful when you see it. And when you turn on the Geiger counter, you understand, ooh, there's a problem here. And the research that they're doing right now indicates, yes, there's obviously genetic attack going on right now because the radiation is much higher than what is normal. We don't know what's going to happen. Some species may not be able to sustain themselves there. Birds are fledging there. I saw swallows nesting, but a lot of them are being born with white spots and they're not coming back after migration, meaning they're weakened or they're picked off by predators. But there's also an interesting population of little rodents, voles, that are also dying earlier, just like the swallows, but they're coming to sexual maturity a lot faster and they're having much bigger broods, which is an indication that nature is responding to this sudden change by throwing out a whole lot of possibilities that one or two or ten of them might mutate or have some resilience against radiation. They're, and this new radiation-tolerant examples or lineage of them, that will become the way that evolution will move off in the future. Well, I have a whole chapter about radiation in this book because we have 440-some nuclear plants in the world, and several of them have multiple reactors. And if humans were gone, I went to one of the newest ones, Palo Verde in the state of Arizona. It's the last one built in the United States. And I asked, you know, what happens if there's no people here? And they said, well, the plant shuts down. I said, yeah, so what happens to the reactor? Well, the emergency systems kick in and they keep the water circulating around the reactor cores to keep it cool. I said, what do they run on? Diesel. How much diesel? 7 day supply. Well, figure it out. In 7 days, I mean, I've described most of the nuclear plants on Earth, that the water will stop circulating, the heat of the reactor cores will evaporate, and depending on how much fuel's in them, they will either burst into flames or they will melt down. And then the world is going to have 440 plus Chernobyls to deal with. And I don't know really what that means. Nobody knows. Nobody knows, you know, how nature would respond to that much unleashed radioactivity. But other things that I saw were really rather remarkable in terms of what it tells you about what happens when we lay off a little bit. In the Korean Demilitarized Zone, it's this 4 kilometer wide strip that goes the width of the peninsula. It's got two of the world's biggest, most hostile armies facing each other off on either side of it and within plain sight of each other. They yell at each other over loudspeakers. They point guns at each other. And in the midst of this thing, there is this strip of land that used to be rice paddies and villages, and now it has reverted into a wilderness. And it has become the home for many of the most precious endangered species in Asia, including one of which you may have never seen in the wild because it's the second rarest crane on Earth, the red crown crane, after the whooping crane, second rarest. And yet we've all seen pictures of it because it's in Japanese art, it's in Korean silk art, this beautiful bird with a cherry red cap and black wingtips and black tail feathers, and the rest of it is as white and pure as innocence itself. This is like a holy mythic bird in the Orient. And they just come floating down silently amidst all this bristling hostility. And they land and they just peacefully feed in this wilderness that has reformed. A group of scientists all over the world are trying to convince the two Koreas that they could gain tremendous public relations advantages and a tremendous opportunity to reunify over something that would be a gift to the whole planet if they made the DMZ an international peace park. It would be lovely, and there's a chance that it may happen, but there's also, I mean, the city of Seoul, Korea is now bouncing up against the thing. Its suburbs and the industrial parks in northern Korea are now being built alongside it, and Who knows? But if humans were to disappear, the whole Korean Peninsula, of course, would become a peace park. I went to another demilitarized zone, a war zone in Cyprus. There was a place called Verosha. It was a seaside resort. I mean, it looks Acapulco, kind, you know, one of these lines of modern hotels with balconies sitting over the ocean. It was built in the early 70s by Greek Cypriot money. And then the war, civil war broke out. And when the truce was declared, it ended up on the Turkish Cypriot side of the line. The Turks very intelligently just put a barbed wire fence around it. They didn't let people colonize it because they figured this valuable piece of real estate would be a great bargaining chip when the island came down to reunification talks. 33 years later, it has not happened. But what has happened is that even though people haven't gone in, their nature has, and you've got trees growing through the rooftops, you've got birds and rats nesting in all the hotel rooms. The beach is still full of sunbathers, but they are loggerhead and green sea turtles. I am told that, and what I could see all kinds of just disaster. You know, there's sand dunes in the lobbies of hotels, that none of the buildings is salvageable. So it turns out that what's going to last of ours on this earth, in terms of our beautiful architecture, I mean, it's just the oldest stuff, the stuff that's made out of the earth itself. And across the street from the World Trade Center in New York is the oldest building in Manhattan, St. Paul's Chapel. It's made out of Manhattan schist, which is what the island's made out of. It didn't budge when the plane shook a lot of other buildings so badly that they had to be torn down. And that building may be the last one there until a glacier finally returns. And we can discuss this in question and answer if you want, but yes, I do have to deal with some alternate scenarios of the future, given that climate change is kind of a wild card right now, and there's a few different ways we may be going, including that forest in Manhattan being palmettos and magnolias rather than the native oaks and beeches. I go to the biggest petroscape in the world, the stretch between Houston and Galveston, which is just wall-to-wall tanks and flares and pipelines and cracking towers and all that. And it turns out that it was very interesting to ask, well, what was here before all this? Because it wasn't that long ago. And could that Texas coastal bottomland forest come back again? The answer is, yeah, definitely. For one, that ship channel that connects those two cities is part of the Brazos River, and the Brazos River is heavily dammed, which is why a city as huge as Houston gets to be there. But every one of our dams will go within a couple of centuries. They will silt up, they will spill over, and when they spill over, they will excavate out a hole right in front of the dam, and eventually the thing will just fall over, and we'll have wild rivers, and then all the deltas will fill, and Houston is right on a delta, and it will be buried, and a lot of that that oil infrastructure will be underwater, but it will corrode even if it isn't underwater. Just the volatile hydrocarbons inside of it make them replace those tanks every 20 years or so, and we already have microbes that can eat that stuff. So it's going to be a lot of gunk and goo for a while, but it'll go away. However, in the early 20th century, we started taking hydrocarbons and started really playing with them, and we invented something called plastic. And it turns out that there are no microbes yet that can digest plastic. So all the plastic that was ever created is still around, except for a little bit that's been incinerated. And as I'm sure you're aware, in the post-World War II, it suddenly entered the mainstream. And now, you know, I mentioned the plastic bags before. Well, I learned an enormous amount from marine biologists in England and California about what's happening to the plastic. It turns out that, well, we all know that erosion eventually takes everything to the sea. Even the Canadian Rockies will eventually, you know, go to the sea. Plastic's a lot lighter than rocks, and it floats intact into sewer drains, into streams, to the ocean. We now have in these big mid-oceanic vortexes continent-sized rafts of plastic floating out there. There's a lot more of it out there than is in the landfills. there's so much that the surface area in these vortexes have six times as much plastic mass as plankton mass. And worse, just as wave action will eventually take rocks and turn them into little grains of sand, plastic's being broken up into smaller and smaller pieces. And we all see plastic that's left out in the sun, you know, it'll get brittle, but it doesn't go away. It just gets little pieces. And that's what's happening in the sea, too. And smaller and smaller and smaller organisms are eating it, not just seabirds mistaking a plastic bag for a jellyfish or sea turtles, but all the way down to zooplankton size. They're mistaking things for fish eggs or for something even smaller, and we have no idea what the impact is going to be. But it's probably going to be extremely, extremely significant. And yet the plastic experts told me that eventually microbes will evolve to learn how to digest this stuff. I mean, there's a feast out there. They'll figure it out. But how long will that take? Well, think of this. How long did it take microbes to figure out how to digest lignin or even cellulose in tree trunks? The original trees, when they appeared on land, when they would fall over, nothing knew how to eat them. And before something finally evolved that did, a lot of them got buried, and then they got buried by more and more stuff until they finally got so compressed they became what we call today the Carboniferous layer. That's what our coal is. Plastics are probably going to enter the geologic record. They're definitely going to enter the geologic record. That Barbie doll, she will be a fossil there someday. You know, someone will find this stuff. Well, I look at a lot of other things. I look at our agriculture. I look at, you know, how long would it take a field to turn into a forest? But then I had to understand, well, are we talking about a field that's never been fertilized or one that's been fertilized and then pesticided? And then these days, municipal sludge is spread over a lot of fields. That stuff is laden with heavy metals. That stuff doesn't leach out so fast. Our heavy metals will be a legacy for a long time. Zinc alone, which is not even a heavy metal, 7,000 years it'll last in soil that can't be leached, particularly the stuff with sludge on it. Lead, 35,000 years. Chromium, 70,000 years. I mean, this stuff will be around for a long time. Eventually, though, the plants that can grow there will add their litter and their decay, and a new cap of soil will cover all this stuff. But I don't want you to imagine that this book, The World Without Us, is about me suggesting that the world would be much better off without us, because I don't believe that. I believe that we deserve to be here as much as any other species. And towards the end of my book, I start bringing this around to us. We do have a role here. Unfortunately, because we have developed such prowess, we can now go so far and so fast and dig so deep and harvest so much that we are literally pushing other things out of our way and scooping some of them completely off the planet. And ultimately, this is going to have some really difficult repercussions for us. I don't know if you remember the movie Yellow Submarine. There was that little figure in it that stood on 2 feet, and its head was a scoop that was actually a vacuum cleaner, and it was vacuuming everything up. And finally, there was nothing left. It sort of pointed at its own feet, and it vacuumed itself up, and then there was nothing, a blank screen. Well, some of our legacy to this earth will be quite beautiful. Bronze is a very durable alloy, and our bronze sculpture should last a long time. That's why we know about the Bronze Age, of course. I talk about even things as ethereal as our radio waves. They just keep going off and off into space. It was a Canadian artist, John Lomberg, who was hired by Carl Sagan to design the packet of artwork that is appended to the Voyager spacecraft that have now left the solar system. There are two of them. And in it are some of the most magnificent images that human beings have created in the sounds of many cultures, indigenous people's chant, and the music of Louis Armstrong and of Mozart, the Queen of the Night's aria that reaches the highest note in the repertoire, just to symbolize how beautifully and how far we can reach. Which brings me towards the end of this book to raise a question. Throughout this book, I don't make any suggestions for what we ought to do. I mean, I have some, and we can talk about it if you want to ask me. But I simply let the facts speak. That's what a journalist is supposed to do. And it's, you know, these are facts that so many really informed people all over the world were able to give me their best educated guesses, and truly educated. But ultimately, the facts start to add up to this one, that it may not be just what we do here on the planet, but how many of us are doing it. And so at the very end of the book, when I figure readers have followed me this far, they're not going to abandon me, I pose another little thought experiment, which is one that the Chinese actually have tried, and though some people call it a failure, I think that it's an instructive one that shows us a lot of the issues that we would have to deal with. But it's simply this. Suppose that the world didn't do without human beings, but from now on, all human reproduction, and I stated per woman because it's women who have the child, was limited to one child per woman. Now, I tried to call some researchers in the United States to find out what would happen, you know. Zero population growth movement used to be very big 20 years ago. They're gone. Can't find them. They changed their name to something less threatening, apparently, because they were themselves being threatened. There's a lot of political pressure now about things like birth control and other related activities. So in Europe, I was able to find demographic institutes who were interested in. That's an interesting question, and they ran the numbers for me. And it turns out that at the end of the 19th century, there were 1.6 billion people on the planet. And at the end of the 20th century, 6.6 billion people on the planet. By the middle of this century, we'll be at 9 billion people. That's the United Nations median estimate. And nobody's arguing with it except to think that maybe it's conservative. But if we went down to one child per family, within a century, we'd be back to 1.6 billion. Now, do you guys get Rush Limbaugh up here? I don't know. Do you know who he is? He's already accused me of being a people hater. He hasn't read the book, and he would not have me on the program to talk about this. But look, I'm not saying that I am proposing this. What I'm proposing is that we have to be thinking about this, that the conversation over what to do with the future has to include everything, not just all the ways that we can be cleaner and greener, but also how many of us realistically can a planet sustain. It's an uncomfortable thought. We are hardwired to reproduce. Hey, I'm the second child in my family. I wouldn't be here if this was going on. And plus, you know, I love my sister and she loves me. And those of you who have siblings, you know what I mean. Families are beautiful things, but the planet is a beautiful thing too. And we are faced with some very hard decisions. And the decision isn't as simple as owning a Prius or a compact fluorescent. That helps. And I'm not saying don't do it. In fact, I'm saying do it if you can. But it's really important that we think seriously about what's going on, because every species in biological history that has ever eaten itself to the end of its resources suffers a population crash. And so will we. And the question is, do we want to manage it ourselves, or do we want to let nature handle it for us? Nature is beautiful, but nature can be beautifully and swiftly efficient. And, you know, that's what would happen. Now, there are economic arguments about this. I don't go into this in the book, but I'll just discuss this with you guys briefly. You know, like economic growth, you know, we're supposed to keep growing and growing and growing. And the First World Population Conference, which was held in Mexico City in 1984, my country sent a representative, Ronald Reagan was our president then, sent a representative to say that the United States was against all forms of birth control because it was just a thinly disguised way of promoting abortion. But, and this was the telling comment, he said, the more people there are on Earth, the more consumers there are for U.S. products. Well, that's the logic behind chain letters. And as we know, chain letters collapse. And I don't want to be part of a collapsing chain letter. The same economists who are constantly harping at us that we have to keep growing, they turn around and they tell corporations, you have to get lean to stay healthy. And so now we've got this phenomenon in the United States called downsizing. I guess it happens in this country too. I was just in Alberta. It's not happening there. They've got an overheated economy. But you know, in downsizing, where there are two ways to do it. There's an actually very brutal way of doing it, which is, and it happens all too often, where they just go in and they hand out pink slips on a Monday morning and suddenly your best friends or you are, you know, without a job. Or the benign, humane way of doing it is doing it gradually through attrition. As people retire, you just recruit fewer. And gradually, every day, the corporation is healthier because it's living within its means. It's at a sustainable level of output and income. Well, I think that's what we're looking at here. Either nature's going to hand us a bunch of pink slips, you know, or, you know, and we'll be part of the people handing them out through, you know, resource wars and, you know, and propagating famines, etc. Or if we lowered our reproduction rates, we could gradually bring ourselves down through attrition to a very healthy planet where there'd be a lot more space for everything else, and it would be a prettier space. Now, I don't care how old you are. I don't care if you're 10 or if you're 80. You remember when this was prettier. You remember when that place you used to go to where it was just so beautiful and open and there was those trees, wasn't a strip mall or wasn't a suburb or wasn't a big industrial park. This is the world that we remember, and this is the world that I hope that this book, The World Without Us, by clearing us away to give us a bigger, better picture of what is in our world and what our world could be, gives us an idea of how we could add ourselves back into a mix, into the mix with the other species and live in balance and in harmony with them, not in mortal combat with them. Thank you very much.